Welcome to another episode of Grading Garpax, a special series from the Rebuildable podcast. I'm your host, Matt Gentile, and today we're going to start doing some grading. This episode is going to focus on the first part of the Garpax era from 2003 offseason to the conclusion of the 2008 regular season. This is when Gar Forman was an unknown executive and John Paxson held the title of GM. So let's take a journey back in time. In April 2003, the Chicago Bulls hired John Paxson to replace longtime GM Jerry Krause, the architect of the Bulls dynasty. Even before Paxson's reign as an executive, he was a Bulls lifer. Paxson played for the team from 1985 to 1994, starting in the same backcourt as Michael Jordan. His most notable moment came in Game 6 of the 1993 NBA Finals, when he hit the game-winning three-pointer to seal the Bulls' third straight title. After his playing days, Paxson served as an assistant coach during the 1995-96 season under Phil Jackson. The following year, he started a seven-year run as the team's radio color commentator. Paxson remained a fan favorite in Chicago, but the decision to bring him on as GM was somewhat unconventional at the time. Bulls chairman Jerry Reinsdorf also interviewed longtime executive Jim Stack and former Bull B.J. Armstrong, who was seemingly being groomed as Krause's replacement. Reinsdorf said at the time, however, that Paxson had always been on his short list of candidates, and he always thought that his competitiveness would make him an ideal fit for the role. Paxson inherited a team coming off a 30-52 season, led by Jalen Rose and young pieces like Eddie Curry, Tyson Chandler, Jamal Crawford, and the previous year's number 2 overall pick, Jay Williams. Many expected that a fresh set of eyes could help get the team into playoff contention soon. However, only a month into his new gig, Paxson faced his first bump in the road, when Williams injured himself in a motorcycle accident. The injuries sustained in the crash ended up being career-ending. Without Williams for the foreseeable future, Paxson decided to use the team's 7th overall pick on Kansas point guard Kirk Heinrich. During the offseason, the team also added veterans Scottie Pippen and Kendall Gill to help bolster their chances of competing for a playoff berth in the 2003-04 season. But after a dismal 4-10 start, the team chose a different course of action. Paxson fired then-head coach Bill Cartwright and hired former Suns coach Scott Skiles. From that point on, the transition began. Gone were holdovers like Jalen Rose, Eddie Robinson, and Marcus Fizer. Following a robust 2004 offseason, the Baby Bulls took shape. Anchored by a young core of Heinrich, Ben Gordon, Lou Aldang, and Andres Nocioni, Paxson had set a solid foundation going forward. After a shaky 0-9 start at the beginning of the 2004-05 season, the Bulls' young core flourished and finished the year with 47 wins, clinching a playoff berth for the first time since 1998. Despite having a 2-0 lead on the Washington Wizards, the Bulls lost the next four games and were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs. Still, the future looked bright, and the Bulls built off their success the following year. Even though they had won 6 fewer games than the previous season, the team pushed the Miami Heat to 6 hard-fought games in the 2006 playoffs before being eliminated in the first round for the second consecutive year. The Heat, led by Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade, would go on to win the NBA championship that June. Thanks to a shrewd trade made the previous year that sent Eddie Curry to the New York Knicks, the team was primed with cap space and the number 2 overall pick heading into the 2006 offseason. After adding Tyrus Thomas in the draft, the team stole center Ben Wallace away from the rival Pistons. Reports also circulated that the Bulls were interested in acquiring Kevin Garnett via trade, which would have bolstered the team into an Eastern Conference contender. Unfortunately, the trade didn't come to fruition, and the team came out of the summer with Thomas, Wallace, and veteran forward PJ Brown, who was acquired from the New Orleans Hornets in a trade involving Tyson Chandler. But even without a bona fide star in the mix, that year's squad won 49 games and saw significant growth from both Ben Gordon and Lou Aldang. The 5th-seeded Bulls faced off against the Heat again in a first-round matchup, but unlike the previous year, this time, the Bulls knocked off the defending champions in a convincing sweep. Unfortunately, the momentum didn't carry into round 2. The Pistons took a 3-0 lead on the Bulls, and despite winning games 4 and 5, the Bulls were eliminated in game 6, ending their playoff run. The hype would continue to grow in the 2007 offseason. Many NBA reporters and analysts thought the Bulls would add a final piece to the puzzle. All-stars like Kobe Bryant, Paul Gasol, and again, Kevin Garnett were linked to the Bulls. However, Paxson seemed reluctant to part with some of his young pieces, mainly Lou Aldang and Ben Gordon. Even without adding a proven star, the Bulls were still picked to be a top seed in the East entering the 2008 season. However, tensions started to crack the solid foundation Paxson built. Both Deng and Gordon rejected contract extensions heading into the year, causing some friction with the organization. Also, head coach Scott Skiles was starting to wear thin on his young core, and after a 9-16 start, Skiles was fired that December. Jim Boylan, that's B-O-Y-L-A-N, stepped in as an interim coach the rest of the season, but the team still struggled. And after trading Ben Wallace to the Cleveland Cavaliers, it was clear Paxson was content on retooling. The team finished with 33 wins and missed the postseason for the first time since 2004. There's no doubt that Paxson set up a solid foundation in his earlier run as GM. His young core showed plenty of growth and promise from 2003 to 2008, and that three-year stretch of playoff appearances certainly helped reinvigorate a fan base that was dying for competitive basketball. But still, Bulls fans are left wondering what might have been if Paxson found a way to add a star to the mix. All right, let's bring in our guest to help us grade this period of the Garpax era. Our first guest is the host of the Bulls HQ podcast. Joining us from Australia is Mark Karanzoulis. Mark, how's it going?
Good, Matt. Thanks for having me, man.
No problem. Thanks for coming back on. And making his rebuildable debut, the host of the Bulls Beat podcast, the legend, Doug Tonis. Welcome, Podfather.
I feel weird that I've been nicknamed by Fred, but I am excited to be here.
So I've been fans of both of you dating back each to your times at Bulls Confidential. Doug, I've been listening to your podcast since college, back when I would download your podcast on my computer and then transfer it to my MP3 player so I could listen to it on the train. Mark, I used to read your posts on Bulls Confidential and really start diving into your podcast more frequently the last couple of years. And the one thing that I've noticed about both of you is whether it's in your guys' writing or your podcasting work, you both seem to have a certain level of admiration for the baby Bulls. And that's why I wanted to have you both on today to go over this period. And I'll start with you, Doug. What did you enjoy most about this era of Bulls basketball?
I think there's just one memory. I went to the first playoff game in the 04-05 season. Those who watched that game would remember it as the Nocioni game, where everyone was chanting Nocioni at the end of the game. And it was the loudest to this date I have ever heard the United Center, including playoff games I went to in the Jordan era. It was just incredible. Just there was such a hunger for playoff basketball to be back after the Krause era. It was unbelievable. Besides the moment, maybe a general theme that I remember was probably, you know, just feeling like we could actually make something of this again. I know you look back on it and you kind of feel like that's very difficult because we never had a star player, but this was coming right around the era of the Pistons, who had just won the title without really a transcendent superstar. And so it didn't feel like such a crazy way to build up a team, to have a really good player at every position without having a superstar at anyone.
It's hard not to look back fondly. I mean, in thinking about and just going over all the transactions, all the storylines of that era, the 4 to 5 year era, I think the thing that stands out most to me is the fact that I typically like rooting for an underdog. I typically like rooting for defense first teams. And I typically like rooting for teams that have been organically built through the draft. And I guess that baby Bulls era, sort of that culmination of that team, sort of reflects in those three, I guess, key phases or key elements, if you want to refer to it as that. So knowing that I like rooting for that type of team, I suppose, then this team was always going to have some sort of impact for me personally. So it's not a surprise that I ended up really gravitating towards that era. And it was probably for me at least, being in a different country where I suppose where I digest and sort of interpret the game a little bit differently, because obviously the geographical differences, like the internet sort of became a thing where you were able to access games a lot easier in the early 2000s from, you know, a country like Australia. Getting into a team from a completely different another country was a lot easier to digest Bulls basketball in, say, 2001, 2002 than it was in 1993, as an example. So this was probably the first sort of era of Bulls basketball where I completely dove in and fell in love with the team as well. And I think just that whole culmination of things is why I look back on that era so fondly. And it probably helps as well that you know, the preceding 3, 4, 5 years before this team were just complete hell, that it made it a lot easier to love this team as well.
You know, Mark, when Jerry Reinsdorf hired John Paxson as GM, what was your initial reaction to that? Was it sort of a surprise to you, or something that, you know, you sort of rally behind?
I wouldn't say it's a surprise, given the type of people or the type of, or, you know, the fact that the team typically targets people that have some sort of affiliation with the organization. But like, going back to that last point that I just made, I think we were just so done with that Krause era at that point that it could have been anyone, just someone that had a semblance of a plan, someone that could put together something of note. I think we all would have been pretty happy at that point. I know there's some defenders of Krause and the whole, you know, I guess bringing Curry and Chandler and going with Crawford as well, and maybe going for that sort of high risk, high reward approach. I'm more conservative in that nature. I would have just kept the whole Outland brand thing going. But for me, I was just done with that era. I didn't want to watch terrible basketball year after year after year. So the fact that Paxson came in, it wasn't necessarily about Paxson and who he was. It was more so about just the fact that it was going to be a change and something different and hopefully some better basketball around the corner.
I agree with Mark a lot in that respect. And I think one of the big things to note was Paxson was on the air. He was well-liked. He was a hero from the old era. He was someone very easy to root for. He was kind of down to earth. No one liked Krause forever because Phil Jackson pitted Krause against the team and against really the fan base. And so the fans didn't like Krause. And when he failed to deliver, you know, new good players to the team, and people still blamed him fairly or unfairly for the breakup of the Bulls, I think everyone was very excited in the fan base to see Krause leave. And I think with a little bit of hindsight, I feel a lot better about Jerry Krause, but I was in that group at the time. Like, thank goodness this guy is gone. And I thought Paxson was a great fit to come in and take over.
So despite this being grading Gar Pax, Gar isn't really in the picture yet as a prominent figure. To refresh our listeners' memories, Gar was a scout when Paxson started and was promoted to director of player personnel in 2004. He wasn't bumped up to GM until 2009, so we'll talk about that more in our next episode. Before we start grading from the 2003 offseason through the 2008 regular season, let me quickly explain how this works. Mark, Doug, and I will grade Gar Pax in 4 categories on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being the highest, 1 being the lowest. Those categories are draft records, free agency signings and re-signings, trades, and coaching decisions. We'll be taking into account the good and the bad, and yes, we'll focus on the missed opportunities too. I'll be tallying at the conclusion of each segment, and we'll read each of the final scores at the end. So let's get started with the draft record. From 2003 to 2007, most of John Paxson's notable draft choices followed a clear blueprint. They were high-character guys from decorated college programs. Prior to Paxson's arrival, former GM Jerry Krause targeted mostly high-risk, high-reward players, including high schoolers Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler. So the 180 in philosophy made perfect sense. Paxson selected Kansas point guard Kirk Heinrich with the 7th overall pick in 2003. The following year's draft is often cited as one of Paxson's best as an executive. He not only selected UConn guard Ben Gordon 3rd overall and Duke guard Chris Duhon in the 2nd round, but he also traded a future first rounder and the draft rights to Jackson Rohrman to the Suns for Duke forward Luol Deng. Heinrich, Gordon, and Deng were vital pieces for the franchise. Heinrich was a solid player throughout his Bulls career, averaging almost 11 points per game and 5 assists in 2 separate stints for the franchise. Gordon led the team in scoring every season throughout his 5-year run with the Bulls and notched the 6th Man of the Year award during his rookie year in 2005. Despite raw skills and some early bumps in the road, Deng grew into a solid two-way player and became a cornerstone for the franchise. During his 10 seasons with the Bulls, Deng was a 2-time All-Star and earned All-NBA Defensive Second Team honors in 2012. In addition to Heinrich, Gordon, and Deng, Paxson selected Florida center Joakim Noah 9th overall in 2007. Powered by relentless energy and hustle, Noah emerged into one of the best big men in the league and a fan favorite in Chicago. His skills as a passer, rebounder, and defender made him a jack of all trades. Noah's signature season came in 2014. He not only won Defensive Player of the Year and earned All-NBA First Team honors, but he also finished 4th in MVP voting. Despite drafting solid players throughout this period, Paxson wasn't completely flawless. Prior to the 2003 draft, the Bulls worked out Marquette guard Dwayne Wade, but weren't in a desirable position to draft him. According to multiple reports, the Toronto Raptors, who had the number 4 pick, were willing to trade with the Bulls. However, Paxson supposedly was hesitant to part with veteran forward Donyell Marshall in a trade package, and he decided not to pull the trigger. Marshall was later traded that December to the Raptors, and Wade, well, he went down as one of the best guards in league history. Paxson's other questionable choice came in the 2006 draft. Texas forward LaMarcus Aldridge was viewed as a safe choice following a very decorated college career. While Paxson seemingly favored players like Aldridge, he looked to break the mold this time around. LSU forward Tyrus Thomas was a raw, freakish athlete oozing with plenty of potential. The Portland Trailblazers, who sat number 4 overall, coveted Aldridge and knew he wouldn't make it past the Charlotte Bobcats at number 3. So the Bulls agreed to draft Aldridge second and traded him that evening with a second round pick for the draft rights to Thomas and forward Victor Criapa. Unfortunately, Thomas would go on to have a wildly erratic career with the Bulls, never quite reaching the ceiling many had hoped for. He was traded to the Bobcats in 2010 and was out of the league by 2015. Meanwhile, Aldridge would become a 7-time All-Star and is entering his 14th season in 2020. Still, there is no question Paxson's notable draft choices had profound impacts on the franchise. They not only were solid players on the court, but each of them also brought a winning culture to the Chicago Bulls. All right, so I want to start with the 2004 draft class. Let me start with you, Mark, because you've talked about this on a few of your podcasts. How big was that 2004 draft class early on during the run of the Baby Bulls?
I can't believe we're going to skip 2013, when it all started with Kirk Heinrich. I mean, come on.
We're going to get there. I got that coming up.
Good. But I mean, 2004 really changed the team. I mean, Ben Gordon at number 3 was a great selection. Then when you can trade for Lowell Deng at number 7, I mean, those two guys were a fixture of the Baby Bulls. We remember that era because of those two guys in large part. So, I mean, that draft was huge for the Bulls. I mean, it literally changed their trajectory where, you know, you bring in two guys who can come in and start. I mean, I know Ben Gordon wasn't necessarily starting at that point, but he's a starting caliber player. And guys with had huge upside. I think we forget about Lowell Deng and the potential that we thought he had through years 1, 2, and 3. He never necessarily reached the heights that we thought he may get to. But, you know, the player he was when he was sort of coming in and how notable he was as a prospect coming in as well. I think we sort of forget about that, knowing what Deng's career sort of played out, maybe even Ben Gordon too, given how his career sort of got cut short. But that draft really did change the trajectory of the team. You add those two guys with Kirk Heinrich, and you bring in Chris Duhon as well and a few others. And suddenly, within 12, 18 months, Paxson had really turned the situation around, brought in players that made sense for, I guess, that gritty, typical identity that we sort of associate with Chicago basketball. And like I said before, they were names that we probably knew that weren't going to be star players as such, but again, they were those sort of underdog players, those defense-first players that you love to root for. Maybe not necessarily Ben Gordon as a defense-first player, but his offense, he saved us a lot of the time. So that draft was pretty instrumental in building this Baby Bulls era.
Yeah, I would only add, and I agree with everything you just said, Mark, that year in the draft was the Baby Bulls era, right? I mean, those were the guys. Those were the team core guys that you were really, you know, building around. Kirk Heinrich would probably be the next most important guy when you think of that era. And I know some people will argue the Gordon Heinrich point. But without getting into that, getting those two guys in that year was huge. And then Chris Duhon, as you said, was a great filler off the bench. And I think even though Nocioni wasn't a draft pick, you know, he still kind of felt like part of that class in a way as a new player they got. The one thing I think is really worth noting, because Paxson has been typically viewed as a very conservative general manager, but that trade of a 2005 first round pick to get that pick from Phoenix was a really big risk at the time. I mean, that was a pick that could have easily ended up being very high based on what the Bulls' recent past was. And you have to think, if you're Phoenix, that you're expecting to get a lottery pick and probably a good lottery pick the next year, based on the recent pass. So that was a pretty aggressive move to bring in Lual Deng and make that class happen and really help get the Bulls run off and going.
It's amazing that, you know, a trade like that was able to really come into fruition, because you think, like, in today's NBA, could you really move back into, you know, into the lottery part of the first round with a second round pick essentially and a future first? Like, that, I don't know if you could have pulled that off in today's NBA. I don't know if you could.
Yeah, I mean, the league's changed. It's, I think that's something that we need to factor in here when we maybe we don't. I mean, the league has changed to the point where I think it's gotten smarter, and maybe Paxton was sort of on the fringe to a degree back in that point where he was being able to find that competitive advantage in the draft. But I think it has changed. But, you know, this type of deal now, I don't know if you see something similar to it. I mean, we've seen some draft moves happen in the last couple of drafts where teams are sort of giving up future firsts plus a draft pick in that specific draft as well. Whereas here, it seemed like a clear win now that we know how it sort of played out for the Bulls. But at the time, like Doug sort of suggested, giving up a future first round pick, I think teams were probably more conservative in that nature, or at least they should have been, as we'll come to learn in a few years later on, that adding to this baby Bulls era, the Bulls sort of reap the rewards of a team being silly and giving away a future first. So it's always a bit of a risk, but it worked out on this occasion for the Bulls.
I'm going to do some rapid fire questions here. First one, which had a broader impact on the franchise, the entire 2004 draft class or picking Joakim Noah in the 2007 draft?
Well, it really depends on how you want to factor this, or what time period you sort of just want to focus in on. Because if we're just thinking baby Bulls era, then I think Ben Gordon and Luol Deng 2004 had more of an impact. But if we're thinking more from a longevity standpoint, then obviously Joakim Noah becomes more of an important draft pick in that point. So it really depends on what time period we want to cut it off and just focus on. But if we're just thinking of who we traditionally think of as the baby Bulls, I think Gordon and Deng had more impact than Noah at that point. I think Noah became more of a force with Derrick Rose in, say, 2009 onwards. But for this specific era, I would say the 2004 draft itself was more impactful in terms of the players it brought in. We can talk about the Knicks trade later on, but I think Gordon and Deng had more of an impact on that baby Bulls era than Noah.
Yeah, and to clarify, by broader impact, I guess I would mean more for long term. So beyond the baby Bulls era and into, you know, the future there. So you would probably say Joakim Noah if we look in that respect?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ben Gordon falls off. If we're taking that lens, then I suppose Ben Gordon falls off pretty quickly, given that his time in Chicago was, as we've come to learn, not that long. But I think we got to sort of stand up for Luol Deng as well. I mean, he throughout... Well, from 2004 all the way through 2013 was a key fixture in the Bulls as well. Someone this team maybe underrated at points among the fan base, I should say. But I would probably that's a tough one, actually, whether you go the Deng route, whether you go the Joakim Noah route. It's an interesting one. Personally, I would probably say Noah because he's a personal favorite of mine, but I do think Deng gets overlooked at times because to a point I sort of alluded before, I think people had a high hopes of what he could be. He maybe didn't live up to those expectations, so maybe people view him differently, but Deng was a super important player for this team throughout the mid-2000s or into, you know, the 2010-2011 period as well.
I think it's easily the 2004 class. You got 5 quality years out of Ben Gordon. I mean, in that fifth year on the qualifying offer, had an amazing playoff run and some of the most fun playoff games the Bulls have had since the Jordan era against the Boston Celtics. Hit tons and tons of clutch shots. So maybe he only gave you 5 years, but 5 years is still a pretty long time to be exciting. Luol Deng gave the Bulls about a decade, about 10 years. I don't know if that's exactly right, but it strikes me as about right. And I think Joakim Noah was on the team for maybe 8 or 9 years. So to me, Luol Deng's impact over his career, probably similar to Noah overall. And then Ben Gordon still gave you 5 years, and Chris Duhon probably still gave you 3 years of decent play, not amazing play. But you add up that 2004 class, and I think it easily surpasses Noah. Plus, that class was this baby Bulls era, which, Mark, you and I both think of very fondly. Joakim Noah's impact is really largely related to the Derrick Rose era, and it's not the Derrick Rose Joakim Noah era, it's the Derrick Rose era. So I just don't think it's quite as big. You know, that era was more fun, but it was more fun because of Rose. Though, of course, the season where we basically ran Noah as the point guard or point center was pretty exciting, and that playoff series against the Nets that they won was pretty thrilling. I still have to say, for me, it's pretty easily the 2004 class.
Which Bull meant more to the franchise, Kirk Heinrich or Ben Gordon? I'm going to start with Doug on this one. We'll give you a chance, Mark.
Sure. For me personally, it's Ben Gordon. I think he raised what the Bulls were doing a little bit more than Kirk Heinrich. I think, honestly, for the fan base, it's Kirk Heinrich. I mean, if you just look at how they are right now, when Heinrich left, you know, they're playing a video for him, and everyone is cheering and excited, and people weren't really excited about Ben Gordon, and very few people are excited about him now. So maybe that will soften in time, and maybe enough time has gone by that it has. But I think Kirk Heinrich, for the fan base at large, was definitely more beloved, and so I guess that means more for the franchise. But I think Gordon had a bigger impact on winning in this particular era.
Mark, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to try and take the emotion out of this one as much as I can for myself, but it's such a subjective point to the, like, I don't know what the criteria is of the question, and I don't know if we can specifically define criteria, because it's almost up to the individual as well, because, I mean, if we're talking purely talent, purely quality of player, then Ben Gordon was a better player than Kirk Heinrich. I'll cede that point, but in terms of what the player meant to the franchise, not necessarily just for this specific era, but just generally over time as well, then I think longevity proves that Kirk Heinrich was the, I guess, more beloved option, as Doug sort of alluded to there. So again, it comes down to the individual criteria each person has. I mean, if you're prepared to take the 4 or 5 years that Ben Gordon was in Chicago over what Kirk Heinrich did over a period of time, then, you know, fair enough. I'll agree to disagree. But at the same time, if you're someone who's more inclined like myself to value what Kirk brought, not only during the Baby Bulls era, but maybe beyond that as well, which I'm probably in the minority when it comes to the latter years, I think that's where it gets interesting. But it ultimately depends on the individual, what they value, how they define success, what they love in their player, and those sorts of things. So I don't know if we can come to a common answer, but obviously I'm going to vote Kirk Heinrich in this situation. But at the same time, I'm willing to concede that Ben Gordon was a damn good player. And this whole Kirk versus Ben Gordon thing it's kind of dumb just generally, because they both kind of really fit with each other perfectly. So the whole concept is really dumb to me.
I want to go back to 2003 when the Bulls picked Heinrich. We know there have been multiple reports about the Bulls' interest in Dwayne Wade and a proposed trade that was axed by John Paxson because it involved Donyell Marshall. Let's start with you, Mark. Given the roster situation and Jay Williams' injury, do you sort of give Pax a slight pass for not trading up for Wade?
I give him a pass in the fact that, maybe not a pass, but I mean, what Wade become, I don't think anyone was expecting Wade to become. And a lot of the times when we do this sort of, you know, when we go back in time and sort of look at these things years before or years after they've happened, I think we think of the players as to who they become versus who they were at that point in time. So I don't think anyone expected anything remotely close to what Wade did here throughout his career to have happened when he was pick five or whatever it was with the Miami Heat. So I think these perspective or this lens that we apply on things are sort of flawed to a degree, because we can't almost separate the player that Wade became versus what he was at the time. So whilst I'm willing to maybe give Paxson some sort of a pass, at the same time, I understand anyone who would come to this conversation and say, well, Paxson's conservative nature in terms of wanting to keep Donyell Marshall on board and not willing to move him in a potential deal for Wade. I can understand that criticism, but at the same time, I think the conversation of Wade versus Donyell Marshall and Kirk Heinrich is almost flawed or set up to fail because of what Wade became versus what the other players became, I suppose, and to the point that no one really knew what Wade was ever going to be in terms of what he became, and I think that point is always sort of missed. So it's one of those situations where you can say, yeah, I don't give Paxson the pass, but at the same time, did anyone expect Wade to become this Hall of Famer that won 3 titles? Probably not.
Yeah, I have to wonder why you're giving John Paxson a pass for not trading up for LeBron. I mean, as long as we're going to talk about deals that never really existed and didn't happen, you know, the Raptors said this deal wasn't on the table. The Bulls said this deal wasn't on the table. There was some rumor that this deal was on the table, and people have just lived by it for so long. And there's really no particular reason to believe that this deal actually could have happened, given that both teams – have publicly said that this wasn't available and that they weren't going to do this. And so I guess I get it. But if you do view it there, then I would say Paxson was on the job for like a few months at this point, is still trying to get his bearings. Probably makes sense that he wasn't going to walk in and make major risks without having done the research for a very long period of time. But I just can't blame a GM or a team for not trading up to do something when you don't really know what the deal was potentially there or not there. And like I said, this rumor was just something that was denied by both front offices. So I'm not sure why it sticks around so much in some people's heads as this thing that absolutely could have been done.
Well, just to add to that, I mean, like, it's probably because it's Dwayne Wade and the fact that he's a Chicago guy, obviously came through the Bulls at some point, not necessarily when Paxson may have wanted him. So I think there's some elements as to why this continues to rear its head. But I think the other funny thing to think about with this as well is obviously Kirk Heinrich was picked at number 7. We can almost draw this scenario again, and we may be doing this in 10 years down the line with the whole Wendell Carter draft where, you know, people are, it's probably not as hot a topic, but people were suggesting that the Bulls should have traded up from number 7 to number 4 or number 3 or number 1 or whatever it may have been in the 2018 draft and go for a player like Marvin Bagley or Luka Doncic or whoever it may have been. So it's just funny to see that scenario sort of replayed itself out all these years later on, 14, 15 years later on. But I kind of agree that trading up is kind of a risky situation, and we've seen the Bulls do this, trade up, and it hasn't necessarily worked out the way we had hoped. So I think if you're trading up, you need to be damn sure that what you're getting is going to be a Hall of Fame level talent or an all-star level talent. We can sit here and say that obviously Wade became that player, but whether he was guaranteed to become that player in 2003, I just don't think we had that same assurity.
Before we assign a grade here, I want to briefly discuss the 2006 draft with Tyrus Thomas. So two-part question for you, Doug. One, were you on Pax's side for rolling the dice with Thomas over LaMarcus Aldridge? And two, how differently would things have been with LaMarcus Aldridge in tow? Because, D-Rose probably wouldn't end up on this roster that way.
I think I was definitely in the Aldridge camp, for sure. I understood why they took Tyrus. If you looked at pretty much any of the metrics that you grade out college players for and how they'll translate to the NBA, Tyrus Thomas just destroyed Aldridge in every single one of them. And it was just one of those things where it just made sense. Aldridge was actually had huge red flags, besides having, I think it was a large hip injury just recently. He was someone who was a very poor rebounder in college, which is very bad for a big man. He had low block and like steal numbers. It just didn't like his markers showed like maybe not that athletic, and you know scored through superior size. And Tyrus just had great numbers and all these things that typically are more accurate at projecting talent. That said, I still like Aldridge a little bit more because he seemed to fit exactly what the Bulls were looking for at that time. And this kind of big man that could generate his own offense and generate his own shot. I think you nailed it. If you took Aldridge, you'd certainly have been much better off in that baby Bulls era. You know, obviously Tyrus didn't work out, but at the same time, you wouldn't get Derrick Rose. And I think if you look back at that baby Bulls era now, you kind of realize that that was sort of a flash in the pan team. You know, Ben Gordon didn't keep up on the track. He looked like he might be after his rookie year. Luol Deng's best year of his career was his third season, and he never played better than that. You know, Kirk Heinrich had an amazing year. I think it was his fourth year, and then never played better than that again. You know, you had a bunch of guys who just all peaked at like 22, 23, and then went downhill, which is just really bizarre when you look at it in a vacuum. And Aldridge would not have been enough to pull them out of that type of thing. So in the end, it definitely worked out better that the Bulls got Derrick Rose. But that's a terrible argument to make in like whether this was a good or bad pick, that it just so happened that it got them Rose later by random butterfly effect. It was obviously a very poor selection.
So I'll say that, surprisingly, I was actually a super big I won't. I guess Garpacks weren't a thing back at this point, but I'll refer to them as Garpacks. But I was a Garpack supporter, and a lot of it was because of this was a team built out of the draft, and I appreciated that. I won't say conservative nature. I mean, some will suggest as much, but I kind of liked the way Paxton was playing this thing, where he was taking players that made sense, that had good reputations, that we just, at this point, the Bulls just needed good players. We talked about the Karras era before, where that 4 or 5 year rebuild just didn't really amount to anything, and the roster really didn't amount to much, and there was just not enough good players on the roster itself. So the Bulls just needed good players, and that's what they got in Kirk Heinrich. They got that in Ben Gordon. They got that in Duhon and Deng, obviously, as well. And I was of the view that LaMarcus Aldridge should have been the pick. I understand the move for, you know, trading for Tyrus Thomas and the whole upside conversation. But if I was in charge, I would have gone with the whole Aldridge decision, because to what sort of Doug suggested there, he sort of fit where this Bulls team was headed. He was more of that option at the power forward, and it's what they needed, that scoring option at power forward as well. It's funny, like, we've gone through years supporting this team where it's always been one position of need this team needed. Throughout the Baby Bulls era, it was a power forward. Throughout the Derrick Rose era, it was this need for a shooting guard or a wing of some sort. So there was always this position that eluded the Bulls, and it just seemed like Aldridge fit better than most. And I would have been conservative in this draft as well, and would have gone with LaMarcus Aldridge. I wasn't a huge Tyrus Thomas fan coming into the draft. I think that sort of proved true throughout his NBA career as well, for various reasons. But it's interesting, because I would have liked to have seen what this team would have become. And Doug rightly notes that this Baby Bulls era sort of quickly fell off after 3 or 4 years. But I just wonder, having a player like LaMarcus Aldridge, though he's probably not your typical number one option, or at least the number one option you'd hope for, I just wonder what the careers of Ben Gordon, Kirk Heinrich, and Lowell Deng look like, how they differ based around a player like LaMarcus Aldridge. Does he make it easier for those players, and do their careers in Chicago, do they have a lot more longevity, and does their peak not necessarily end so soon in Chicago? I don't know the answer to that question, but if you just think or look at it on paper, Kirk Heinrich, Ben Gordon, Lowell Deng, LaMarcus Aldridge, and then Joakim Noah in 2007 coming in as your center, I mean, that's a pretty damn good team in a weak East. Maybe it doesn't win anything, but maybe all of a sudden you've got 5 good starters, guys that you could potentially package in a trade, and maybe make some moves if things sort of played out a little bit differently. But it's always going to be one of the biggest what ifs of the last sort of 20 years for this organization. It's one that I constantly think about even to this day, but I would have gone Aldridge.
Let's get to the grades here. So on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate the draft choices from this period? Mark, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, it's tough, because, I mean, the first 3 or 4 years or whatever it was, they were as good as you probably could have hoped for based on where the Bulls were picking at that point. You can make the whole argument of whether the Bulls should have traded up in 2003, and maybe that should factor into this grade. And obviously, the whole Aldridge and Thomas thing may influence grades as well. So depending on, again, what your individual criteria and how you want to define it is, to me, I'd probably give it maybe a 3.5 or a 4, because that Aldridge and Thomas trade was something that I just didn't agree with at the time. It's not necessarily a hindsight decision. It was something that I just didn't necessarily agree with at the time. Maybe I wasn't as angry about it because of Paxson's track record through 2003, through 2005. I was maybe willing to give him that benefit of that doubt. Obviously, we know how it played out beyond that, but that trade with the Knicks really helped, I guess, maybe temper the expectations or failed expectations of what I had for that specific move in not keeping Aldridge. So I'd probably give it maybe a 3.5 or a 4, somewhere in that vicinity, because that Aldridge trade, like I said, I still think about it. I still wonder what would have could have been. Obviously, it didn't play out the way I hoped it would, but there was still a lot of good things that Paxson did in the draft through that era, to the point where I still think I can give him a good mark.
How about we average that out to like 3.75?
We can do that.
All right, got it. What about you, Doug?
I'm going to go with about a 4.5, and I think the only blemish here, obviously, is the Tyrus Thomas pick. But just to put this into context, and the Bulls were drafting number 2 here, Andrea Bargnani, basically a bust. LaMarcus Aldridge is clearly the guy they should have kept, and will always associate Tyrus with Aldridge. But the next pick, Adam Morrison, totally a bust. Tyrus Thomas, totally a bust. Next pick, Sheldon Williams, totally a bust. And why do I bring this up? If you look at these top 5 guys, it's not like the 2003 draft where you just picked up a Darko and you had a bag of superstars around you, and you picked the only guy who sucked, you missed out on the only guy who was any good. You know, so it was a draft class that didn't end up being strong at the top, had a lot of disappointments. And so while the Bulls didn't make the right pick, the context of why they made that pick was not poor. There was a good reason why they took a swing for the fences on Tyrus. It didn't end up working out and was a bad selection. But I'm only going to ding them a half point on that, because the aggressiveness of trading up to get Luol Deng and then really knocking out of the park their other picks, and even finding someone like Duhan getting great value in the second round, I just think that is so much better. And then, you know, you also, we haven't talked about it so much because it wasn't part of the Baby Bulls era, but getting Noah in the next year, who was not a guy who was super popular with the fan base, but was also the kind of the best player available. I just think, you know, you nailed almost every pick. Every franchise has misses. You had a miss in a group of guys where four of the five top five players were misses. So I think it's also a little bit more excusable than if four of the five guys were really great.
So I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. Pretty much agree with you guys. The 2004 draft to me is a major factor in this because it really did set the foundation. The 2007 draft, getting Joakim Noah, who ended up being a game changer for your franchise. And really the only ding that I put on here is Tyrus Thomas, but it wasn't the most egregious thing when you look at the totality of that draft. So I'll go with a 4 out of 5. And just to recap again, Mark had a 3.75 out of 5, Doug a 4.5 out of 5, and I have a 4 out of 5 for the draft choices for guard packs. Let's get to the free agency signings and re-signings. When John Paxson was calling the shots in this period, the Bulls didn't dive deep into the free agency pool very often. Aside from a brief flirtation with Los Angeles Lakers guard Kobe Bryant in 2004, Paxson was laser-focused on building a young core through the draft. In fact, his earliest free agency pickups consisted of veteran role players. From 2003 to 2005, the Bulls either signed or re-signed guys like Othella Harrington, Gennaro Pargo, and Malik Allen. During that same time span, Scottie Pippen and Kendall Gill were the only players Paxson signed who were previously All-Stars. Both were in the twilight of their careers and were nowhere close to being the same impactful players they had once been in their primes. Signing Pippen, actually, was viewed as more of an olive branch for the organization, following a very messy divorce in 1999. Paxson did have one under-the-radar signing that paid dividends. In August 2004, the Bulls picked up forward Andres Nocioni. Nocioni, who won a gold medal that summer with the Argentinian national team, enjoyed 5 productive seasons with the Chicago Bulls, averaging over 11 points and 5 rebounds per game. He perfectly complemented the young core of Heinrich, Gordon, and Deng, and his tenacity and fiery passion made him a fan favorite in Chicago. There's no doubt the most notable free agent pickup from this period was Ben Wallace. Some viewed Wallace as a key piece that would raise the Bulls from a playoff contender to a title contender. While he was never an offensive threat, he was a decorated player on the defensive side of the ball. During his time with the Detroit Pistons, he won Defensive Player of the Year 4 times and was named to either the All-NBA 2nd or 3rd team 5 times. Wallace certainly fit the Bulls' defensive identity. He played a role in the team winning 49 games in 2007 and advancing to the second round of the playoffs. However, the Bulls regressed in his second year, and Wallace noticeably was starting to decline on the court. Despite signing him to a 4-year, $60 million contract the summer before, Paxson pulled the plug about a year and a half later. Wallace was dealt to the Cleveland Cavaliers in January 2008. Was he the sole reason for the Bulls' struggles that year? Absolutely not. But it was obvious that he was not the big fish that could catapult the team to a true contender. The league was certainly different at the time. And earlier in the period, the Bulls' roster situation really didn't call for major splashes. But as the team rose to playoff contention, Paxson could have explored adding more valuable role players via free agency. So let me preface by saying that free agency was much different back then. It's clear Pax's blueprint was to find veteran leadership early in the rebuild. The two moves that I'm about to talk about right now, they weren't signings, but they opened the door to bringing in bench pieces like Ofella Harrington, Malik Allen, and Gennaro Pargo over the years. And I'll start with you, Doug. Did letting Marcus Fizer go via the expansion draft and releasing Eddie Robinson actually help set the tone for 04-05?
I think to some extent. I think certainly Robinson was a guy they probably wanted to get out of there because of his attitude. I don't remember Fizer necessarily having that bad of an attitude. It's hard to really go back. I remember thinking he wasn't a particularly good player. But, you know, I would say probably to Mark's point, certainly in that year, John Paxson had a vision of bringing in character guys. They very much focused on bringing in character guys. And if they, you know, let these guys go, I think that probably was a good piece of what they were doing. And clearly that character was a big part of that team and the direction.
So, I mean, going back to my earlier point about character being a key thing for Paxson, I think we're seeing it now. We definitely saw that with the Jim Boylan hiring in terms of, you know, having him replace Fred Hoiberg. Paxson wasn't happy with some of the habits being formed, let's say. He put it that way, that the team was sort of establishing under Fred Hoiberg. So he brings in a hard-nosed guy like Jim Boylan. Obviously a different situation, but letting go players like Fizer and definitely Eddie Robinson, again, it comes back to bad habits, character issues, however you want to frame it. I think it's sort of always lumped into the same sort of thing, or at least can be positioned that way. That's what I'm sort of referring to as Paxson having his type, having his expectations of what a player should be about and what they should be doing ultimately. So I think it was the right decision because, like we said before from the outset, we had gone through 4 or 5 years of that Kraus era where he brought through high upside guys. We can talk about if Eddie Robinson was a high upside guy or not, but I mean, he got rid of that guy that was supposedly just about talent, weren't necessarily the high character type of players. He replaced them with those high character players, and we got to live this era because of what Paxson did throughout this point. So this is why I look back on this era so fondly, because they were guys that were Paxson sort of guys, but they were guys that came in and worked hard and ultimately got the results. So I was glad to see the end of those guys.
Let's do a couple of rapid-fire questions real quick before we grade signings and re-signings. First, I'll start with you, Doug. Was signing Ben Wallace in 2006 a wasted move?
Well, I mean, in hindsight, clearly. It didn't work at all. It was a bad contract for 3 years. When the signing happened, I thought he would maybe be a decent contract for 2 years and you'd eat the last 2 years. I wasn't a big fan of the move, but it was a move that very much made sense in the fact that the Pistons were the team in front of us. And so you took away one of their very core pieces. You added him onto your team. GMs pulled the next offseason, said it was, or that offseason said it was the best move of the offseason, and the Bulls are viewed as a title contender that year. So I think it was the type of chance you have to make, but it was a chance that ultimately did not work out well at all. And a big reason it did not work out well at all was not even just Ben Wallace, but it was the decline I mentioned earlier of every single one of the players on that team at ages that you typically do not expect decline.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the way I like to frame this, the way I like to think about it, it was Wallace was the perfect player or the right player at the wrong time. So I understand why they went after him. I understand why it was seen as a favorable deal. But I think at that point, Ben Wallace was 32 years of age. Had he been, obviously, this is he probably doesn't come to the Chicago Bulls at this point, but had he been maybe 28 or 29 years of age, then I think that changes how he maybe remember that specific signing. And obviously, the Bulls did good things in 2006, 2007. We didn't get maybe the longevity. Doug sort of mentioned even just 2 years. We didn't even get 2 years of good Ben Wallace at that point. But he was the right player at the wrong time. That's the way I like to think about it. I mean, the type of player he was, the type of culture setter he was, the type of player he was on defense specifically, I think he fit what this organization was about at that point in time. So, yeah, he was the right player at the wrong time. And had he been a little bit younger and had we been able to reap a few more years of his prime, I think it would have been a good signing. But it didn't obviously play out that way.
So second question here, and I'll start with you, Mark. Was Andres Nocioni the best free agent signing from this period of the Bulls?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting one. In terms of return for money, probably. I mean, I'm a sucker that I always like those end-of-the-bench signings. So as Mrs. Maynard. I'm a big David Nwaba fan, so like those 1 year minimum deals for players who are probably don't mean that much. They're the ones that excite me a lot. So when you can bring in someone like Malik Allen or Darius Songalia or someone like that, I get pretty hyped about those types of moves. But I think you have some, you know, you have a point, or at least you have some merit here in suggesting that Nocioni probably was the best signing. He obviously wasn't the biggest name, but dollar for dollar, then at least based on what he contributed to the team in prior years, or throughout the baby bull era, I suppose, I think he probably was the best free agent signing. He wasn't, Doug sort of mentioned it before, we maybe think about it as a draft pick, sort of making that draft pick or coming into the team when the team was making a whole bunch of draft pick selections, but he was technically a free agent signing. So he probably was the best value deal that the Bulls signed through the, say, 2003 to 2007 era. I would probably agree, unless I'm missing someone off the top of my head, but he's the one that probably brought the most value to this team.
I can't disagree with anything Mark said. The only thing I would add is you could make the case for Ben Wallace if you don't look at the overall impact of signing him, but you just think of it was the Bulls getting the number one free agent that was available, stealing someone from the Pistons. If you looked at the signing, at the time the signing was made, it was like, oh my God, I can't believe we just got Ben Wallace. But then clearly when you look at any type of hindsight and results of what happened, Nocioni was a positive player, 3 years at, I think it was $3 million a year, $9 million total, was a very high quality player for the team. And Ben Wallace was a bad contract for, you know, 3 years, only two for us and two for Cleveland. But, you know, we just got their trash when we got Larry Hughes. So it really ended up just sitting on the books for 4 years in a lousy way for the team. So can't really go wrong by saying no. And I don't think you forgot anyone, Mark. It was just a period where there was not a whole lot of free agent action.
Yeah, I mean, further to that as well, I mean, I will say, again, Nocioni represented a competitive advantage that the Bulls sort of seemingly had over the league at that point. I mean, there was a few teams doing this, but bringing in someone like Nocioni from overseas, that was, again, they were exploring different options to a lot of teams who were just focused on US-born players, I suppose, in terms of filling out their roster. But the Bulls were a little bit more creative in that at that point, where they were bringing in a player from abroad, someone who wasn't necessarily on the radar of a lot of teams. So to get a player in like Nocioni from a different league, a different country, and having him become a really established and credible role player on this team, one that I still fondly remember, I think that, I remember that signing fondly, not just because of what he created, but the fact that the Bulls were using a specific avenue of team building that maybe other teams weren't using at that point in time.
Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate the free agency signings and re-signings during this period? Mark, why don't we start with you?
I mean, to Doug's point, like, it all hinges on Ben Wallace, really, and it really depends how you want to frame it up. Do you think about Ben Wallace, the signing, in terms of who he was as a marquee free agent? I mean, we like to make fun of management for not necessarily securing the number one headliner in free agency. They obviously did that in 2006 with Ben Wallace. We don't think about it in that lens because it never worked out, or at least it played itself okay for one season, but then in the following few years were a complete disaster. So it really depends on what perspective you want to apply to it. But if we just factor it all together, maybe I give the whole free agency from maybe 2003 to 2007, somewhere in that vicinity, maybe a 3, because I think it's hard to look at the Ben Wallace situation without thinking about what it became or what it quickly became. Maybe if we got 2 or 3 good years out of it, maybe it's a completely different conversation. But yeah, it's probably a 2.5 or a 3. So maybe if we're going to do the whole average thing like we did before, maybe I'll say 2.75. But it's hard for me to ignore what the Ben Wallace situation became, even though prior to it becoming what it did, it was perceived as a pretty damn good signing.
So are we going with 2.75 or 3?
We'll go 2.75 for consistency's sake.
I like the way you're scoring this. Doug, what about you?
I'm going to go with... I'm going to join Mark on the 2.75 bandwagon. I think in the end, all the signings on the margins were good. Nocioni was a good signing. All of their little signings, guys like you mentioned, like Malik Allen and Darius Angala, were good signings. You know, it's decent signings. And then Ben Wallace was like, if you didn't go for Ben Wallace, it's not like there was anyone else. Like, that was the name that was available in free agency. And so they went out and they got the number one target. And so that was like great in a sense, except that in the end, it worked out really badly. And it wasn't like it was crazy hindsight to say that this guy whose game is based primarily on athleticism might not age super well when he's 32. I was a little bit critical of the signing at the time, and I felt that they should have just, you know, tried to stick with Tyson Chandler, even though he had just crumpled up into a little ball and cried in the corner all year the previous year. I thought you still take your best bet on a guy who's like 23 years old and 7'1", rather than a guy who's 32 and like 6'7", playing center position. So it's not entirely hindsight for me that this didn't end up working out super well. So I'm right with Mark for pretty much the same reasons.
Ah, fuck it. I'm going to go with the trifecta, 275.
All right.
There you go. All right. So recap across the board, 275 out of 5 for the free agency signings and re-signings during this portion of the Garpacks era. Let's go to the trades.